listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Tomorrow is the FCC vote. We will be talking about this more as we go on through the program. Bernie Sanders on Saturday is going to be in Iowa. I'll let you know some information on that. There's a lot going on in the news. And some of it has to do with, you know, the state of the media. And Michael Smirkanish has been thinking about this a lot over the years. He's been in the middle of it for many, many years. And he has a new novel out, a novel of politics in the media. It's titled Talk. And Michael Smirkanish, of course, the host of the Michael Smirkanish program on XM Sirius on the POTUS channel, number 124, 9 to noon Eastern time, Monday through Friday. He's the host of Smirkanish on CNN. And Saturdays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And Smirkanish, Smirkanish.com is his website. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. You know, you're one of the good guys, and you write a hell of a book. So
thank you for that.
I'm curious, you know, first, just in general, your thoughts on the state of the business that you and I are in.
Deplorable. And I wanted to write a book that drew attention to the fact that I think it has led Washington astray and taken the country with it, because all this polarization that causes gridlock in Washington, all the obstinance, I think grows out of our business. I look back at the last 25 or 30 years that I've been a participant and paying attention. It's a time of increased polarization in the media as well as in D.C., and I think the two are causally connected. I think that the media is in large part driving the bus, and I mean the world of terrestrial talk radio and cable television news.
Isn't that, though, I mean, I don't recall when you started in radio. I started in radio in 1967 and in commercial radio. And I was working at WITL, AM and FM, Lansing, Michigan. And it was the number one station in town. It was, you know, country western. But we had a talk show in the afternoon, the Chuck Drake Show, Chuck Mefford, one of the three guys who was the owners of the station. And it was kind of a Smirkanish show. I mean, it was Chuck was a conservative, kind of Chamber of Commerce conservative Republican businessman. But, you know, he took all, you know, conversations. And it wasn't highly partisan. But what was interesting was that there were similar shows on other stations. There were like five or six stations in Lansing. I worked at least four of them over the next 10 years. And all of them were owned by local people. To the best of my knowledge, there's no longer any locally owned stations in Lansing, Michigan. There might be one. And isn't it possible that in 1982, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and we had this explosion, we had the mergers and acquisitions mania and this whole new category of job opportunity of M&A specialist, you know, and the Michael Milkins of the world, and this incredible consolidation of our media began, that and along with it, the vertical integration of our media. We saw this broken up in television with the primetime rule. We saw this broken up in the movie industry back in the 1930s or 40s, where the studios couldn't own the retail outlets. This has not happened in the radio business. Could it not be that there are business models that are driving this, and it's not like, you know, evil talk show hosts or bad producers or anything else? It's just the way that the business is structured?
Well, maybe. I mean, your experience in Lansing sounds a lot like my experience years later in Philadelphia. It's funny how we remember. My station was 96.5 FM WWDB, or as we called it, the talk station.
Right.
And when I think about the lineup on that station in the early 1990s, there was a guy named Irv Homer. He was a libertarian before the rest of us had ever heard of Ron Paul. We had an unabashed liberal named Frank Ford. He was married to the Democratic district attorney in Philadelphia for many years. There was a conservative named Dominic Quinn, but he was best known for his command of the English language, not ideology. And Tom, the guy that I've been thinking a great deal about recently is Bernie Herman, because he did the 10-to-1 slot at night, and his moniker, his shtick, his brand was the Gentleman of Broadcasting. And I used to come in and guest host for him when he would go away on vacation. Today, if you knocked at the door of a program director and they said, well, what are you all about? And you said, I'm the gentleman or the gentlewoman of broadcasting, you're not getting across the threshold.
No.
And I don't ascribe it primarily, the change, to ownership changes, although that's a reality. It was still owned by a family when I was getting started. But I look at the rise of Rush Limbaugh in the early 90s at a time of the first Gulf War, and that really set the stage because, and I would argue, conservatives rightfully believed they didn't have a place that they could call home. They established talk radio as their clubhouse. The shock is that here we are these many years later, people have never had the amount of choice that they can exercise, but they don't. They gravitate toward the like-minded in the usual clubhouses.
But they don't have
raise awareness of the danger that possesses.
I mean, they don't have the choice. You've got, you know, Clear Channel owns about half the major sticks in the United States and about half the minor sticks, and they own Limbaugh's show, Hannity's show, Beck's show, and just pay these guys a salary. So they're making all the money from their own programming. SiriusXM is moving to that model. Cumulus, has just recently become the major competitor for Clear Channel. Cumulus controls, you know, they bought Westwood One, so they bought our show and all the other, you know, they don't own this show. I independently own it, but, you know, some of them are. But they distribute it, and we're not on a single Cumulus station, and which makes me scratch my head and wonder about the future. But they're developing. I mean, you know, they just hired Mike Rogers out of Congress, right wing, you know, Republican conservative, to come up with a new kind of, you know, they're developing their own lineup to go up against Premier on the right. And I think that there's some truth to what Limbaugh used to say, and that is that on the left, there's just as much demand for intelligent conversation about the issues, but on the left, it's largely satisfied by NPR. And so on the right, they come up with this reactionary stuff as a counterbalance to it. Could it not be that my biggest, you know, problem and competitor is actually NPR?
I believe that. When I say there's a tremendous amount of choice, I don't mean simply in radio dialogue. I mean internet, I mean cable television, I mean satellite radio, and I'm always shocked by people who, and I have friends like this, who are conservatives, and they rely entirely on Fox, Drudge, and talk radio.
Right.
I similarly have friends who gravitate toward liberal outlets, and it's like never the two shall meet. My argument is, you know, open your mind, listen to some alternative points of view. It reminds me of an issue, Tom, that's playing itself out this week relative to commencement speakers. I don't understand the millennials who are unwilling to sit there and entertain for 20 minutes a point of view that might not be in sync with their own. If you can't do it on a college campus,
you're talking about Condi Rice. Yeah, I would argue that there's a qualitative difference between Condi Rice and William F. Buckley. There's a difference between a principled alternative point of view and a war criminal. But that's a whole separate argument, and we can have that another time.
Well, here's what
I'm curious. We just have 2 minutes. We have a minute and a half left, Michael. I'm curious. We're at 1 minute left. I'm curious if you'd like to talk back to Lars Larson. He's saying to you that you are, you know, well, you can characterize it however you want in this minute.
I haven't read it.
Oh, okay.
I haven't.
Well, he basically says that, you know,
haven't read it. So you'd have to summarize.
Conservatives don't lie, ever.
Well, listen, I can't believe that the talking points that I hear day in and day out from talk radio hosts on the right, where the only change is the intonation of the voice, I can't believe that's the way they see the world. I don't know people who see the world entirely through liberal or conservative lenses. They don't comport with those that I interact with in my real life. They only exist in a media-driven world, because when I'm interacting with folks, they're liberal on some things, usually social issues. They're conservative on things, usually financial issues. And there's a heck of a lot, Tom, that they just haven't figured out, and they're not afraid to say so.
Yeah.
But the certainty that exists in the media world is an aberration.
I think you're right, and it's one of the reasons why almost every single day we have conservatives on this program, and I wish more of my colleagues would do it. Michael Smirkanish, host of the Michael Smirkanish Program on XM Sirius, POTUS Channel 124, and Smirkanish on CNN on Saturdays at 9 a.m. And his new book, really worth checking out. It's a novel, Politics in the Media, called Talk, smirkanish.com. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work, my friend.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, I got a new one, by the way. The Republican chaos theory that I was telling you about yesterday, they've got it's just going full tilt boogie with the VA. I want to tell you about that after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew, senior producer with The Big Picture, 7 o'clock Eastern time. Figure out your local time. We're on the air in 106 countries or something like that all around the world. That's not Andrew. That's Andy. Hang on just a second. Okay, and Andy, my apologies. I just dumped your call. My mouse is not working. But Andrew, hey, Andrew, how are you?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
Good. Yeah, you're welcome. The GOP is no different than Boko Haram?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they're not running around burning, setting fires to towns and kidnapping schoolgirls. But
actually, Andrew, with regard to the gay issue, look at the 90-some trips that it wasn't Jim DeMint, it was one of the Republicans in Congress made to Uganda before they finally passed a law outlawing homosexuality, which has led to literally people's houses being burned down and people being murdered.
Right. But as people know, Boko Haram is the group responsible for kidnapping over 200 schoolgirls in Chibok, Nigeria, and they're still holding them hostage. And the real premise behind the kidnapping is that, like most, or if not all, Islamic militant groups, Boko Haram doesn't want women to be educated because they fear female empowerment. And that seems to be a real trend within the Republican Party today here in the U.S., from what they're doing to try to restrict abortions, to restricting access to birth control, to opposing gender pay gap bills, to cutting funding to programs that help single mothers raise their children. It's just a consistent pattern of Republicans waging the war on women, and surely it has to be because they're afraid of the power of women to change society.
Yeah, yeah. And it's happening. And then we're going to get from that topic, we are going to segue into our Lone Liberal Rumble. Cameron Stewart and Andrew Kloster are going to drop by?
Yep. We're going to start off talking about the GOP and their fear of women. Then we're going to talk a little bit about net neutrality and the latest from the FCC regarding the net neutrality rules.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get into Karl Rove's numbskulled comments about Hillary Clinton having brain damage, and should the GOP and the Republican Party be listening to Rove after these kind of comments? We'll also touch on a Nebraska Senate candidate who thinks that religious beliefs trump everything and that you can get away with anything if you assert your religious beliefs. Pretty wild, right?
Just ask Boko Haram.
Yeah, exactly. We'll also touch on a federal court judge striking down Idaho's ban on gay marriage, mm-hmm. and finish off talking about and asking the question of whether or not Senator Mitch McConnell is responsible for U.S. veterans dying.
Yeah, and it's a startling number. I read the list that you put together this morning for our daily take of as I recall of pieces of legislation that the Republicans have filibustered that Mitch McConnell has shot down that would have helped our veterans during the last 6 years.
Yeah, I mean, and Republicans right now are trying to put all the blame on Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki, but
and by implication, his boss, the president.
President, exactly. But had they passed these bills, chances are good that a lot of veterans would still be alive today because they would have had access to the health care they needed.
Yeah, amazing. Andrew Campbell, thank you, Andrew. Great talking with you. We will see you in a few hours. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Here we go. I got to tell you, this thing, I want to go off on it. First of all, if you have thoughts on the state of talk radio, you know, the conversation that Michael Smirkanish and I were having, which was far too short, unfortunately. I mean, that's part of this medium as well. But, and I hope Michael understands, you know, heartbreaks, and I'm sure he does. But, you know, what do we do about our media landscape? I mean, I'm just a big fan of not just in media. I think that we have the same problem. Look at our obesity problem. There's a new movie out. There's a great op-ed about it in today's New York Times, about this new movie, about the obesity problem in the United States. And it tracks back to the 1980s when we came out with these food standards that said eat less fat, which was a very well-intentioned thing. Eat less fat, have fewer heart attacks, right? It was like a, you know, push back on the Atkins thing or whatever. So people started eating less fat. Manufacturers started making food with less fat in it. What do they replace the fat with? Sugar. Turns out sugar is more toxic than fat. Sugar is more likely to cause cancer. Sugar is more likely to cause inflammation in your body. And guess what it is that causes the production of cholesterol and the clogging of the arteries? Inflammation. So sugar leads to more heart disease than fat does, according to this new movie. So why do we have all this sugar? Because we have this massive vertical integration in the food industry. Our food is brought to us by about five companies. Or maybe 10 or 15 if you include the retail distribution outlets, the retail, you know, the restaurants and whatnot. But in terms of growing it, processing it, it's a handful of companies. Oh, and every one of them is giant multinationals, even though they're doing, you know, information, even though they're doing, you know, under multiple different names. So I think that the state of talk, the state of talk radio, or the state of media in general, is not in and of itself a problem. It is a symptom of a larger problem, which is that in every industry in the United States, look at retailing. Walmart has driven hundreds of, probably tens of thousands of mom and pop businesses out of business all across the country. You have hardware chains that have driven local hardware stores out of business. Just pick your business. Stationery stores. Look at how many mom and pop shops, Staples, Mitt Romney's company has put out of business. And this is all because Reagan changed the rules of the game in 82. But back to the Republican chaos plan, strategy. The Republican chaos, I originally call it the chaos theory strategy, but chaos strategy is good enough. The Republican chaos strategy depends on the knowledge, the absolute knowledge that the Republican Party has, and it's no secret, that 65 to 85% of Americans cannot tell you who controls Congress. And if you drill down to whether, you know, what is required to pass a piece of legislation and how the Republicans have enough votes in the Senate that they can block legislation, even though they don't control the Senate, they can block legislation with a filibuster. If you drill down to that level, probably 85 or 90% of Americans don't know who controls Congress or don't know how successfully obstructionist the Republicans can be and how basically powerless and impotent the Democrats are in Congress. 85, 90% of Americans don't know that. I mean, just genuinely, don't know that. And so the Republican strategy is, so, hey, we're in Congress, we're going to go ahead and just screw stuff up as much as we can, as fast as we can, as effectively as we can, as often as we can, as badly as we can. We're just going to screw stuff up. Especially for the Veterans Administration, because veterans are sacred in this country, right? So consider this. Back in 2012, the Republican senators blocked a $1 billion jobs bill for veterans. Just 3 months ago, they blocked a $21 billion bill. Mitch McConnell blocked a $21 billion bill that would have expanded the VA specifically. In 2012, they also blocked a bill called the Veterans Compensation Cost of Living Adjustment Act that would have kept veterans' benefits on par with inflation. Before that, they killed the Wounded Veteran Job Security Act. They killed the Veterans Retraining Act of 2009. They killed the Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program Reauthorization Act of 2009. They killed, Republicans killed the Disabled Veterans Home Improvement and Structural Alteration Grant Increase Act of 2009. They killed the Veterans Business Center Act. They killed the Job Creation Through Entrepreneurship Act. Every single one of these bills would have helped veterans and would be law right now if it wasn't for Republican obstruction. So they do all this stuff to genuinely hurt our veterans. And then they have the audacity to go on national television and say, our veterans are being hurt. Quick, somebody, blame it on the administration. It's got to be Shinseki, right? He works for Obama. Where's Obama in all this? I want an investigation. Congress needs to look into this. Naomi Klein wrote a book about this. This is the shock doctrine. You break it, then you blame somebody for having broken it, and then you offer to privatize it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And meanwhile, since 90% of Americans don't realize that the Republicans have this kind of power in Congress, they are blaming it on Democrats because, after all, they hold the White House. So welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, I 2 weekends ago, I was in Portland, and I did a TED Talk from Portland. And it's now up. It's live. It's out there on the YouTube machine. And we put a link to it at TomHartman.com. And so if you haven't seen it, it's a 17-minute talk. Brief. That's the whole point of TED Talks. It's brief and to the point, and specifically about how we need to pass a constitutional amendment to say that money is not speech and corporations are not people. It's titled Lincoln Didn't Fight the Civil War to Free the Corporations. And it's the kind of thing that you're going to want to share with five friends. Please. I would love for this thing to go viral, not because it's mine. I don't make a penny off this. Actually, if there's advertising on it or something, I mean, it all goes to TED. I don't know if there is or not. But I'm sure they've got a business model. But it's an idea that is worth spreading. And a very good idea. So get over there. At TomHartman.com, it's right the link right at the top of the homepage, and get that thing out there. So anyhow, this being a talk show, let's talk about some of this stuff. Andrea in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Andrea, what's up?
Yes, hello. I had a question regarding the investment of we have liberal billionaires and millionaires who have not funded the airwaves. And I would want to know what your opinion is on why that isn't the case. What is going on with that? We may not have the same heft, but there certainly is money in that spectrum. And what's going on with that?
I think there's a couple of things, Andrea. I think number one, Air America Radio, when it was rolled out, the first guy who was the first president of it was actually a thief. I mean, he lied to the investors about the money that was available. He stole a bunch of money. I think he recently went to jail for this thing. And so Air America was always running, you know, a dollar short and a day late. And they ultimately lost something like $16 or $17 million and went down in flames. I was not there at the beginning. I came in to replace Al Franken when he left. And but my show had been on the air before Air America even existed. And I was on Air America while they were there for a while, and then about a year before they finally went down in flames, I bailed out and took my show back independent again. And there were liberal billionaires and millionaires who gave lots and lots of money, lots and lots, meaning, you know, millions, five million, 10 million, lots of money to Air America, and they feel fairly burned by that, or felt. The thing, though, that I think is worth noting is that Fox News lost $500 million a year for 5 years. Now, in the last three, four, or five years, the losses were probably close to $100 or $200 million a year, but they started out losing $500 million a year. They lost this mind-boggling amount of money. You know, Sean Hannity lost millions before he made his first penny, or at least the network did. But they had Rupert Murdoch behind them saying, I will, you know, fund this. I got deep pockets. We're going to make this thing happen. And they put it it's for free. It's on basic cable. So every truck stop in America has got Fox News on. MSNBC, they charge you a $5 premium. So in the television world, liberal talk you have to pay extra for. And conservative talk is freely available. In the commercial radio world, conservative talk is everywhere and ubiquitous. And progressive talk is harder to find. That's one. Secondly, the reason why so many conservative talkers, and there was an article about this a couple of weeks ago that just, it was in Politico, and it got no coverage whatsoever. I talked about it once, you know, for one day here on the air, and I probably should have talked about it more often. But it was about how Limbaugh has gotten millions of dollars in subsidies from Koch brother type right-wing think tanks and billionaires. Hannity has gotten millions of dollars in subsidies. Beck, all these guys, they get millions of dollars. Sometimes it's direct subsidies, like here's some money. Some more often than not, it's please advertise our event in quotes, you know, put it on your website or, you know, promote it on your radio show. Sometimes it is, here's a speaking fee, come and speak to our group, and here's, you know, $500,000, whatever. They're subsidizing right-wing radio to the tune of millions and millions of dollars. Nobody, to the best of my knowledge, has ever done anything like that on left-wing talk radio. You know, that, you know, I mean, it just doesn't happen. I think in the last 5 years, I've gotten one speaker's fee that was like a couple $1,000 that was associated, not even directly, but indirect, you know, it probably invited me to speak because I'm a, you know, the number one progressive talk show host or that kind of thing. And I think there's a reason why. And the reason why is that if you're a billionaire and you want to keep your taxes low, give your money to Sean Hannity. If you're a billionaire and you want your taxes to go up, give your money to Tom Hartman. Well, you know, there's not a lot of billionaires who are real enthusiastic about their taxes going up. And so, and there are so many genuine, I mean, the liberals are actually concerned about what's going on and how do we solve some of these problems in the world. And there's so many genuine crises out there that they're funding things like, you know, vaccine programs and stuff like that. I think the group that is really dropping the ball on this is the Democratic Party. The Republican Party has been supported. There's been a symbiotic relationship between the Republican Party and right-wing talk radio. During the Bush administration, twice a year, George Bush used to invite all the right-wing talk show hosts, never invited me, but used to invite all the right-wing talk show hosts to come over and broadcast from the lawn of the White House. Invite them into the White House, have lunch with them, you know, go out and talk with them, be on the radio. That has never happened in the 6 years Barack Obama's been in the White House with progressive talk radio. And I think that, you know, the Democrats are just like dumb on their messaging. So, Andrea, thank you for the call. And, you know, thanks for giving me an opportunity to I guess, go off on myself. Al in Rome, Wisconsin. Hey, Al, what's up?
Oh, I've got some interesting news on the VA.
Okay. Okay.
In the 80s, I ran into a shrink who worked at the VA. I could never get past ER. And it turned out when he got his orientation,
mm-hmm.
he was told, don't give anything to Vietnam vets because they want something for nothing.
Really?
I think the same crap is still going on.
Now, in terms of don't give anything to them, are you talking about don't qualify you for benefits or don't give you medications, don't give you therapy?
Everything.
All of the above. Basically, just keep them out of the system.
Right.
That's incredible, Al. That's incredible. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, these are the kind of systemic problems that all bureaucracies have, and they're symptoms, I think, frankly, of poor management. But one of the things that really exacerbates poor management is a lack of money. You know, you can't run an organization if you don't have the funds to actually do it and do it well. And if you look at this roughly dozen pieces of major legislation, multi-billion-dollar legislation that the Republicans have filibustered or refused to bring up in the House. During the Obama years, where Obama is trying to deal with the fact that George W. Bush had two wars, sent hundreds of thousands of people overseas, created tens, if arguably hundreds of thousands of wounded veterans or veterans in need of services and support when they return, and did not provide for that, did not pre-fund the VA, did not say, get ready, here it comes, did none of that. I mean, you know, Donald Rumsfeld famously sent soldiers into battle without armor, you know, I mean, without body armor and without armor on their tanks. It was a scandal. Well, it's happening at the VA, too, and it hasn't been discussed that much. So Obama comes into office. He tries to do something about it. And the Republicans block it and block it and block it and block it. And now they're screaming, oh, look at the VA is broken. Why don't and you know what? You know, Uber veteran John McCain's solution to this is, Al. Let's give vouchers to the veterans. Let's give vouchers to them so that they can go out and buy health insurance from health insurance companies that can make a 10 or 20% profit off them or a 30% profit off them and then give more money to Republican campaigns. It's bizarre. Al, thanks for the call. Mark in Bloomington, Indiana, you wanted to talk about Nikola Tesla?
Yeah, I've always been astounded or miffed by the idea that they tore down that very large radio tower in Menlo Park, wasn't it?
Oh, you're talking about the one that Tesla built.
Yeah, the World Radio Tower.
Yeah. I think it was in Menlo Park. Although Menlo Park was Edison's thing and Tesla was Edison's enemy. So actually, I'm not sure. But
Well, I was, that's where he was ousted out of it and then went to Colorado, Colorado Springs, and then they also burned down his laboratory there.
Yep. Yeah. Well, he was talking about things like free energy from the earth, you know. Can't have that.
Yes, totally. Yeah.
But you wanted to point out that Tesla thought that world radio should be free and you know, let's.
Well, you were talking about the Tesla company, which took his name.
Well, I was.
And that kind of.
Oh, you mean in the news story? Yeah, in the news story. Yeah, that's
The company Tesla, which would create a lot of green energy jobs, and I'm really into alternative energy and the.
Well, it's I think it's a good thing. And Mark, thank you for the call. You know, the big challenge is going to be battery tech. It is battery technology, and there have been some really significant breakthroughs. We don't fund basic science in the United States anymore to anything close to what we used to. I mean, we used to do things like invent the internet and send people to the moon. Now the Russians are retaliating for the whole Ukraine thing and for our boycott of them, our sanctions, by saying, oh, you want to go to the International Space Station? Forget it. It's Russian rockets that get our guys up there, right? So it's like we're not investing in basic research anymore, and this is just a fundamental tragedy. And part of that is, what could we do with batteries? We could have an electric revolution if we had a battery revolution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In Science Journal, just a few weeks ago, there was a there was a story about how it looks like it might be coming. But anyhow, we'll back to your calls. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Andy in Heron, Montana. Hey, Andy. Sorry to have dropped you earlier when I thought you were Andrew.
To talk to you. I've been following the Keystone problem. I worked around the oil field in the support position, hauling stuff out to rigs, and I worked as a steel fabricator. And it got me wondering about the pipeline. And when looking around, it looked like they're going to be pumping a molasses-type fluid that they have to put lighter crude in at 1,300-plus pounds of pressure through a pipe that's less than a half-inch thick.
Right.
This is a sludge that's going to cause real problems with abrasion. And I got to wondering about what they're going to do with the waste after it's refined, picturing mounds of pet coke along the Gulf Coast where I was raised. I didn't like that much. Last night, I stumbled upon a published report at priceofoil.org, and it's called Coke. It's called Petroleum Coke, the coal hiding in the tar sands. And it's an amazing little report. Just to mention a couple of things out of the overview of it, that Pet Coke is a refinery priced to move at 25% discounted from coal. It has 13% more CO2 emissions than regular coal. The energy emissions from this product are not listed in any of the reports about the energy emissions for Keystone. And one of the biggest dealers in Petcoke export, it's a huge export for this country. It says from January 2011 to September 2012, the U.S. exported over 8.6 million tons to China, where it was likely burned in their plants.
Yep.
And most of it's done by Oxbow Carbon, who is owned by William Koch, brother of Charles and David.
Yep, yep, I know. And they've got these giant piles of it in Chicago, Detroit, and around the existing Keystone refinery, St. Louis, in the Midwest right now, and a lot of it's blowing into poor neighborhoods, and they load it up on train cars and ship it off to the West Coast, and as you correctly pointed out, export it to China, and where they burn it in coal-fired power plants, or they mix it with coal and burn it in these coal-fired power plants, and they're basically, it's like they're squeezing a little extra money out of what should be considered a waste product. And it never should have gotten here in the first place because, you know, this tar sands oil from Canada is really bituminous coal that's been ground up and mixed with water and oil. And the whole thing is insane, Andy. It's all about, you know, making a buck. And the Koch brothers are going to make a fortune. Their brother's going to make a fortune. There's the big oil companies, the refineries are going to make a fortune. And you know, it's as James Hansen said, If we open up all of that, you know, hundreds of billions of pounds of or tons of carbon that are in Alberta, it's game over for the planet. I mean, this is...
I agree.
Pardon?
I said I agree. It's completely game over. What amazed me about it was that the extra energy caused or put in the atmosphere by burning this petcoke has not been mentioned, apparently, in any of the other studies about what is going to be the effects of Keystone if it goes through.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, the science has been less than rigorous on that, and the study funded by the State Department on it that said, maybe not. That study was done by one of the companies that used to be in the fossil fuel industry. Andy, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carl, listening to us on X-Ray FM, our new Portland affiliate. He's in Beaverton. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hi there. I was just listening to you guys. I've been listening to your show for a little while. Noticed you tend to cite NASA a lot in a lot of your green discussions and a lot of what you tend to refer to as progressive research. NASA, I want to just demonstrate to you, is not a very reliable entity to be citing because of their single-mindedness towards the last two administrations. And I actually have a good example of that that's happening this year, if you'd like to indulge me.
I'm listening.
Currently, there's a satellite heading towards Earth. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's called IC-3.
Nope, haven't heard about it.
Okay, it's the International Comet Exploration Satellite, number 3.
Okay.
It's currently on a 30-year mission and is heading towards Earth right now. NASA, in 1999, deemed the project economically unfeasible to keep contact with and ordered the entire project shut down, along with all of the communication equipment and software be completely liquidated in 1999. Well, someone luckily had a little bit of goodwill in NASA and decided to not shut down the carrier waves of the satellite, and the satellite is still making contact with us. Unfortunately, what was planned in the mission this year was a final burn on the satellite so it could be captured by the moon, initiate its final orbit, and then be captured by Earth for future use. This is a satellite that has no analogs or, experiments that are currently employed in space. NASA deemed this, and still deemed this, economically feasible to continue the project. Right now, there's a Kickstarter that has a deadline of 6 weeks to try and do this on its own. Crowdsourcing is the only way to look at research these days, not singularly minded programs like NASA.
Well, and Carl, I can't speak to the individual details of, or attest to the veracity of what you just said. Although it doesn't sound out of the realm of the possible. But again, look at our government. You've got Republican, and thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to X-Ray FM in Portland. We've got this whole we're in the middle of a Republican austerity agenda. And we have been now for, almost 2 decades. We're still running on Reaganomics after 33 years. And so, of course, basic research is being cut. Of course, NASA's budget is being cut. I mean, they retired this, they basically turned everything over to the Russians with regard to the space station, the International Space Station. And no more. I mean, it's really, really, truly tragic. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. Bob and Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman.
Hi.
I've got a comment and then a question. You started out your program just before your calls about Citizens United and McCutcheon.
Mm-hmm.
It occurs to me that we only have part of the equation when we say that corporations are not people. The other part is corporations are property, as is money.
Right.
Money is not speech, it's property.
Right.
Property is subject to regulation.
Right.
Not only by Congress, but by all levels of government.
Correct. And historically, that's been, up until the 1970s, both of those things, to some extent, were pretty much conventional wisdom. The Supreme Court had made some weird deviations here and there. But it wasn't until Lewis Powell got on the court that we really went full tilt boogie with this corporations are people and they've got free speech rights thing.
My question to you is, why can't the president, since it's my understanding that Citizens United was not decided on anything to do with the subject that brought the case before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't he ignore it as they ignored their obligation to decide cases that are brought before them, not fictions?
He can, but he can't. It's not like they've asked him to do or stop doing something. The problem is you'd have to get Congress to ignore them as well. You know, for example, when Abraham Lincoln said, I'm going to ignore the Supreme Court with Dred Scott and issue the Emancipation Proclamation, Congress supported him in that. And so you had two branches ignoring the Supreme Court and freeing the slaves.
Okay. So and if we had both houses of Congress and the president, we could do something about it.
You could easily do something about that, for that matter. If you had both houses plus the president, that, you know, literally Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, I encourage you to read it, says that the Supreme Court shall operate under exceptions defined by Congress and under regulation by Congress. So Congress could simply pass a law saying that the Supreme Court may not decide that money is the same thing as speech. They could simply pass a law saying that, and the Supreme Court couldn't do it. And as Phyllis Schlafly pointed out on this program a couple of weeks ago, back when he was, you know, majority leader of the Senate, Tom Daschle actually got a piece of legislation passed that had something to do with South Dakota, where it built into that bill was this little piece that said the Supreme Court can't rule on this. I mean, there's precedent for it.
Yes.
So well, it's just, you know.
I appreciate your comments on the subject.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob. Good to hear from you. Lou, in Park Ridge, Illinois. Hey, Lou, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, Tom. First time caller, long time listener.
Thank you.
I work with a bunch of veterans, or I'm in a program with a bunch of veterans at the Veterans Administration in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And these Vietnam veterans have been treated exceptionally well.
So you're pushing back against the guy who said that.
They would vouch for it any day.
Yeah. This is what I'm hearing, too. Although a lot of them fought a long, long time to get Agent Orange recognized.
You're right. One other thing that I'd like to mention, where do these billionaires, where are they going to go when the temperature exceeds the ability of human life to cope with it?
Well, I'm guessing that they're buying land in northern Alaska and the northern Siberia and down in Patagonia and things like that. I mean, it's, you know, the Bush family, I understand, owns a couple hundred thousand acres up in the mountains of Ecuador or something like that. It's the fortress of solitude syndrome, and apparently it's actually happening around the world. Thanks, Lou, for the call. That there are very, very wealthy people who are building these retreats that are completely self-sufficient in very, very remote places. It's bizarre, but there you go.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I mentioned at the very beginning of the program an hour ago that tomorrow is the day that the FCC is holding basically a vote on a vote, I think, would be a way to describe it. But let's get somebody who really knows what they're talking about. Becky Bond is on the line. She's the political director with Credo. CredoAction.com is the website. Becky, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's great to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Tell me, what is the now you've got over 310,000 Credo activists. People can react to this by going over to Credo, C-R-E-D-O, action.com. Over 310,000 Credo activists have urged former lobbyist and now FCC Chairman Wheeler to save net neutrality. I'm assuming that you're asking the, Mr. Wheeler to simply use Title II of the Telecommunications Act or whatever it is, Title II, you, please tell me, to classify Internet service providers as common carriers.
I love how you introduced that as simply, Tom, because it is a really complicated subject, but there's a really simple answer to it. You know, those of us who are Internet users, we're used to the fact that when we go online and use the Internet, that we're in control of what websites that we look at, and net neutrality is the principle that lets us do that.
Right.
But there's been a recent court case that struck down some FCC rules, rules that previously would ensure that companies can't speed up or slow down or block web content based on, you know, who the owners are. And that's all about to change unless we can convince the FCC and the new FCC chair, who you pointed out is a former telecom lobbyist, to take action.
Right.
Now, what's happening right now is that the FCC is considering new rules to decide whether companies like Comcast and AT&T can decide, you know, whether there's a fast lane and a slow lane on the Internet, or if it's going to be like it's always been, where companies like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon are actually not allowed by federal regulators to discriminate against web content. And the way they're going to have to do this is actually do something kind of complicated, which is to reclassify broadband as a public utility. It goes back to the Bush era, when the Bush administration actually deregulated broadband and the Internet service providers. It used to be they had to act like telephone companies.
Right.
I mean, imagine if I wanted to call and order up my cable, and if I called Comcast on the phone, it was patched right through. But if I called an independent service like SonicNet or Monkey Brains here in San Francisco, they just put me on hold. They might put my call through in an hour or so. You know, you can imagine what that kind of discrimination can lead to.
Or alternatively, if I'm talking with my mom, my mom's dead, but if I'm talking with one of my brothers, you know, they listen in on the phone conversation and say, oh, that there's no commerce there, so we'll just charge him the normal, you know, 3 cents a minute for his phone call. But if I'm talking to my business manager, they listen in on the phone call and they say, you know, he's engaged in commerce right now. He's making money on this. We're going to charge him 50 cents a minute for this phone call.
Exactly. I mean, this is something that we have. We have equality on the Internet today, and it's time for a Democratic White House and a democratically appointed head of the FCC and those commissioners to actually undo what Bush did back in his administration and ensure that we're going to have equality on the Internet for all users. I mean, the Internet is not just, it's not like, you know, getting the second tier on your cable TV. I mean, this is how people access information. This is how people start companies. This is how people take classes. This is how people communicate with each other around the world. This is an essential public utility, and we need to make sure that it's regulated properly and that the government, a Democratic administration especially, doesn't turn it over into the hands of companies like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, who we know what they'll do with it. They'll just serve their own monopoly.
Yeah, they'll do the same thing they did with cable television. They'll say, this is ours. And, oh, by the way, would you like a little bit of that? That's $5 in a month extra. You know, and
I think most people like the Internet more than they like their cable provider.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got to, and I think that people are ready to stand up and make sure that we can keep it that way. But the FCC has to take action, and they have to undo this Bush-era deregulation.
So the FCC, are there five commissioners altogether?
Yes.
You have two Democrats, two Republicans, and the chairman, and he was appointed by Obama and is theoretically a Democrat. And so he and the two other Democrats, that's a majority. The three of them could, correct me if I'm wrong, could simply say, and in fact a U.S. District Court ruling suggested that they say, that the Internet is a public utility, and Internet service providers and backbone providers are simply common carriers. They could do that, correct?
That's all they have to do. Their own lawyers have said that's what has to be done if they want to have net neutrality rules with teeth.
We simply
have to vote to do so.
Right. So we know that Tom Wheeler's not inclined to do that, the former lobbyist who's the chairman, although he might be pushed. What about the two Democrats on the commission?
They've already come out and said, hey, we need to take a look at this. We've been hearing, they said we've been getting phone calls and emails. We've been getting massive pushback from the grassroots, and this is something that we need to slow down these plans that Chairman Wheeler announced to create a fast lane and a slow lane in the internet and undo net neutrality. So I think we have a real fighting chance here. I mean, the problem is that Democrats haven't historically been great on this issue. In 2010, there were 74 Democrats in the House that signed a letter backed by AT&T that basically told the FCC, you know, it's fine if you don't reclassify the broadband providers as common carriers. The decision that led to the court case that struck down the net neutrality rules, they said, you know, it's pushed by the telecom industries who are some, you know, major donors, and they gave the signal to the FCC, like, you don't need to stick your neck out on this because we're with the big telecom companies. So this is a replay of that moment, because in 2010, the FCC had the chance to take action and save net neutrality for real. Instead, they passed rules, you know, without addressing the deregulation, rules that their own counsel at the FCC said would be struck down in court. It was kind of like a slow-motion cave on the issue. They tried to, you know, publicly give something to the activists by calling something net neutrality rules, when in reality they did something that they knew was what the companies wanted. But now we get what we rarely get, and we're getting a do-over on these rules
now,
because of the court case.
If they vote tomorrow to simply do the namby-pamby regulation thing and the new cosmetically improved version that the chairman has rolled out in the last couple of days, does that close the door to the possibility of a Title II definition as a common carrier?
Well, this is just the beginning of the fight, Tom, and that's because there's been such grassroots pushback.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are two of the commissioners saying we need to take time, but even if they have a vote tomorrow, this is going to be up for public comment. It's not going to be any kind of final rules that are going to be decided. We have time for internet users, and that's, you know, millions of people across this country, to weigh in and defend their internet.
And to absolutely raise hell.
That's exactly what's going to happen. We're already seeing massive pressure on the House and on the Senate. Thousands of people have been calling in. The telecommunications industry tried to float the same kind of letter that was so successful in 2010, getting members of the House to Democrats in the House to tell the FCC it's okay to side with the big telecom companies on this, and they were only able to get a fraction of the signatures that they were able to get in 2010. So this is one where it's a clear result of massive pushback from citizens being able to slow down the process.
I would think Tea Partiers would be as freaked out as anybody else. You know, we should be reaching out to the right on this too, shouldn't we?
You know, that's a really good point. And, you know, in previous fights on this, it has been a right-left coalition. You have the Christian Coalition, and you have groups like Credo and Move On that are fighting against this together, because really it's about big, massive corporate power versus independents and regular users. So this
right.
is something which is a populist issue. It's not a Democratic or Republican issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a quick question, Becky. We're running out of time here. We're talking Becky Bond, the political director at Credo, credoaction.com. Is this the Credo that offers telephone service?
It is.
Do you if I upgrade to the new iPhone when it comes out later this year, can I have you as my carrier instead of AT&T?
Absolutely. You can have me as your personal customer service agent too.
Okay.
Make that happen.
We got a deal. Becky Bond, political director with Credo, credoaction.com, because I got an old iPhone 4 and the screen is cracked and it doesn't work, but I've been waiting. Anyhow, Becky, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Keep up the great work. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, and so check it out, credoaction.com. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Charles in Stoughton, Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
Mine's today. My birthday's today.
Oh, well, another Taurus, I think.
We're a year and a week apart.
Wow.
Anyway,
how about that?
Anyway, yeah, yeah. Three things. Number one, I think we should have the people that are doing this to get the money out of politics. You call them that are going around the. Anyway, I'm trying to remember what I was thinking about. But anyway, they should tackle into that a mandatory voting law. Mandatory for everyone.
Are you talking about move to amends, amendment to the Constitution?
Right, correct. They should tackle into that a mandatory voting law.
Right.
With a minimum penalty for the first year you don't vote, and it'll increase. And we'll use that money as a tax.
Right. Unfortunately, that's not constitutional, or it's arguably not constitutional, but that's how they do it in some countries. The most famous and the largest of the developed countries is Australia, which has like 97 or 98% compliance people who vote. And the first year that you don't vote, it's a small fine. And I think they pull it out of your income taxes, although I'm not sure. But it's the equivalent of a parking ticket. It's like a $25 or $50 fine.
Right.
Second time you don't vote, it goes up a whole bunch. It goes up to a couple hundred dollars. Third time you don't vote, it goes up a lot more than that. And frankly, I don't know the details of it. These are four example numbers. But right. I would love to see something like that in the United States. But you know, you've got Republicans out there working so hard to try to prevent people from voting.
What we do is we tell them it's a patriotic duty, just like they did with 9/11 with the war in Iraq.
Right.
It's your patriotic duty. Let's tack patriotism to it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. Thanks a lot for the call, Charles. Great to hear from you. Billy Sue, watching Free Speech TV in Goleta, California. Hey, Billy Sue, you wanted to talk about lithium?
Hi, Tom. Bill Smiley.
Hey,
here
Billy,
in Goleta, California.
How you doing?
One of your listeners. I'm doing great, and I'm going to get better.
Okay.
And the reason I'm getting better is because of you.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your work with the barbershop today, but I'd like to really talk about probably the world's most largest deposits of lithium.
Oh, they're in Afghanistan. Hello?
They're in Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah. This report came out from the CIA like about, 8-10 years ago, saying that Afghanistan was sitting on $1 trillion worth of rare earth minerals, including large quantities of lithium.
Yeah, we probably bumped that up to 10 trillion.
Wow. Wow.
I don't mean to talk over you.
No, that's fine.
I apologize.
I think you probably have a cell phone.
Okay. Afghanistan's GNP was $2 billion when we went in there.
Right.
And I would guess that every single Afghan could get educated, get food, and lift them from poverty, which is the secret to success, because of lithium batteries. Now, if I were the Chinese, I would be negotiating with Afghanistan right now.
The Chinese are.
Russian, I would be negotiating and apologizing to bombing Afghanistan.
Yeah, the Russians are too. The Chinese and the Russians are in a lot of places. They're all over Africa. They're all over the Middle East. They are negotiating with these governments. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot at stake here. Billy, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Your talk media for the rest of us. Jay in Naperville, Illinois. Hey, Jay. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom. One thing I wanted to say was that, I just graduated this Saturday with my bachelor's at the age of 44, thanks to the
Hey, good on you. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Thank you. And you know, while going to school, I had to do some research for an economics course, and I came across a white paper that I found interesting, which led me to do more research in the fact that one of the problems that it's why there's such a big gridlock in Congress, they think, is because at its peak in the 80s, veterans composed about 3/4 of Congress.
Right. Well, that's because probably 70 or 80% of American men during the 40s had been drafted and sent off to World War II. And then there was a substantial number of people who were drafted and sent off to Vietnam in the 60s and early 70s.
Right. And then the last World War II veteran in Congress just passed away, I think it was last week or...
Right. But we haven't had a draft since 73 or 74, whenever they ended the draft, so...
Right, and the reason, though, this white paper, they looked at every, they even looked at the mental state of veterans and so forth, because they seem more willing to look at issues in a bipartisan way, mm-hmm. as opposed to their loyalty is to their country.
That's right.
Not to their party.
Well, if you're in the military, you can't be partisan. You're not allowed to wear your partisan badge on your sleeve. I mean, you just can't do it. That's why, you know, in 52, when Dwight Eisenhower ended up running for president as a Republican, there was all this speculation for a year running up until that, you know, in the year after retired from the Army, of whether he'd be a Democrat or Republican. Nobody knew.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons. If we had one thing that really angered me and really got me away from ever voting Republican was the day where George Bush landed on the aircraft carrier, yeah. and said, you know, mission accomplished. That same day, they used that incident to cover up that the biggest cuts to veterans' benefits were passed through Congress very quietly on that day.
Oh, man.
And, I mean, they're still recovering from that.
But,
so when we went into Iraq, you know, as you said, they didn't pre-fund any of this. No, they defunded a lot of that, lot of the programs that were going to be needed once they knew that soldiers would be returning home, soldiers like myself.
Right.
You know, I'm labeled as I have a 70% disability for PTSD.
Uh-huh.
It took me a year and a half to receive my benefits. And, you know, the service is great. Yeah, I mean, I'm very thankful for it, but it is somewhat slow in instances. And I think if veterans really want to help each other, the best thing we can probably do is, like you say at the end of every program, tag your it. I think we need to become more politically involved.
I agree with you. And I agree with your premise that one of the reasons why Congress is less willing to consider the good of all and more into this kind of Paul Ryan selfish me thing is because there are fewer veterans in Congress. Because actually, the ultimate socialist institution is the military. It's totally socialist. I mean, it's arguably Marxist communist. The military pays for your food. They pay for your housing. They pay for your clothing. They pay for your medical care. They pay for your retirement. They pay for everything, basically. And in exchange for that, you give them whatever you can give them, you know, in terms of the work that you can. So it's almost a from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. And when those people then go into Congress, they have at least some sense of the commons. They have some sense of we're all in this together because they've been there. They've had to rely on somebody else covering their back. Whereas you get somebody who's just, you know, been a business person or just, you know, fresh out of college, wet behind the ears, and some billionaire decides to fund them, and it's a whole different world. Jay, thanks for the call. Well said. Excellent point. Austin in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on TuneIn Radio on the Progressive Voices channel. Hey, Austin, thanks for listening to Progressive Voices. What's up?
Yes, I had a question about the Crash of 2016 thing that you speak of.
Mm-hmm.
I heard speak of it before.
Yeah, my book.
Parts. And the first part of the question would be, what would one expect to see in terms of, you know, X percent unemployment, diminished purchasing power of the dollar, jobs being evaporated, or things
right.
like that?
If it's anything like previous crashes, I think what we're going to see is go back to 2008. And, you know, where you're losing 600,000-700,000 jobs a month, where the purchasing power of the dollar is actually radically increased because money becomes dear. This is a deflationary crash. Interest rates are collapsing. Unemployment is pushing through 15, 20, 25%. And, you know, I believe it's going to be a replay of 1930.
So I just have this idea of the Depression being like, you know, it took wheelbarrows of money just to buy bread.
No, that was in Germany. And that German hyperinflation was an exception. There's two ways to create inflation. One way is to have a common good, a core good, be scarce. In the 70s, when the Arabs cut off our oil because they didn't like our policy of supporting Israel and the Six-Day War and all that kind of stuff, oil became scarce. The price of oil skyrocketed. We had inflation, and Carter and Reagan had to deal with that, or the Fed had to deal with that by jacking up interest rates. That's the typical way that inflation happens. 99% of the – in Zimbabwe right now, you've got 10,000% inflation. Why? Because they're out of food. because, you know, they're, I mean, literally they're out of food. There's multiple causes for this without getting into it. But the German experience was an exception because after World War One, the Treaty of Versailles imposed this multi-billion dollar penalty on Germany for all the damage that they did in World War One, and they said they had to pay it back in German marks. And so the government simply inflated the currency by printing German marks. That's not happening here. That's not going to happen here. That hasn't happened pretty much anywhere in the world since Germany did that. So that's not the kind of inflation you have to worry about. It's got nothing to do with the national debt. It's got nothing to do with the Fed. We have to worry about deflation. Austin, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more right after this. And yeah, I'll lay out a few more thoughts on the crash of 2016 if you'd like to. Stick around. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very omnipotently ugly, the good. Eddie Vedder, Pearl Jam singer and one of my line producer's favorite musicians, joined a group of 50 other rock stars, actors, and artists yesterday in writing a letter to the FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, asking him to protect net neutrality. The letter said, "The open Internet's impact on the creative community cannot be overstated. The Internet has enabled artists to connect with each other and with audiences, allowing broadband providers to control this once open platform, shifts power away from individual artists, and interferes with freedom of speech and expression." I couldn't have said it better myself. I just hope Tom Wheeler is listening. The bad. Creepy Richmond, Virginia dads. Outrage is growing today over reports that a Richmond, Virginia high school senior named Claire Ettinger was kicked out of her homeschool prom because her dress was too racy for some promgoers. Apparently, a few of those dads saw Ettinger in her dress, which was well within the prom's length requirements, and then complained to a chaperone that it was making them think impure thoughts. Yes, that's the verbatim quote. The chaperone then asked Ettinger to leave the dance. That's right, a high schooler was removed from her prom because a handful of creepy middle-aged dudes couldn't control their own libidos. Talk about blaming the victim. And the very, very ugly, the New Orleans Police Department. An audit conducted by the New Orleans Inspector General's Office has thrust that law enforcement agency into a heated controversy over its crime reporting practices. According to the audit, the New Orleans Police Department had misclassified sexual assault at least 41 assault cases as miscellaneous incidents. While it's unclear why the cases were misclassified, the audit did note that New Orleans does have a rape rate that's 43% lower than other cities with high crime rates. In other words, it looks like the New Orleans Police Department may have intentionally mislabeled sexual assault crime to make the city seem safer. That's what actually happened? That's very, very ugly. Time will tell. So, anyway, that's what's going on there. And Gene, who listens to our podcast from Reno, Nevada. Is it Nevada or Nevada? It's Nevada, isn't it?
Nevada.
Yeah. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Yeah. I just wanted to correct a source that Jennifer Granholm was actually the originator of the word Shafta.
Really? Tell me how and when.
Yeah.
And why and
It's on a website called On the Issues, Jennifer Granholm on Free Trade. You can Google that or find it.
Okay.
I remember her saying this. I saw, like, I either heard a clip, saw a video. I don't know where it was, but it was back at the time when she was rerunning for her reelection bid in 2006. It says here it's from her book, A Governor's Story by Jennifer Granholm, in 2006. At a UAW Local 699 in Saginaw, quote, "We've seen our jobs leave on a fast track to Mexico, on a slow boat to China, on the internet to India," I declared, pumping my fists. The hall erupted with a loud applause. "NAFTA and CAFTA has given us the Shafta," I shouted, and the crowd of workers roared in response as if ready to tear the heads off of those who had made profits by outsourcing jobs.
Yeah, now, you know, I mentioned Shafta to one of the labor guys on my TV show the other day, and he said, we used to say, you know, and I said, I'm trying to get people to use the acronym SHAFTA to describe TPP and call it the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, S-H-A-F-T-A, SHAFTA. And he said, you know, one of our slogans used to be NAFTA and CAFTA have given us the SHAFTA. So that's an old UAW thing.
Right. I think they might have gotten it from her because this was a UAW local 699.
Yeah, or she got it from them, one or the other.
She was giving it.
Yeah.
She was giving it to them apparently.
Yeah.
But I think the big challenge, and
good on Jennifer Granholm. She's one of the good ones. She's brilliant. She's thoughtful. She did a great job on television. She did a great job as a governor. I haven't heard a peep from her in a while. I wonder what she's up to, but I hope she's doing well. But what we have to do now is get people to refer to TPP as SHAFTA, which is a slightly different thing. And actually, I think it's an appropriate acronym because there are Southern Hemisphere Asian countries involved in the TPP. And so it should be called the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, S-H-A-F-T-A. So, but thanks for that bit of trivia, Gene. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening to our podcast. David in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, David, what's up?
That was kind of a cool conversation talking about the origins of the term SHAFTA, but that's really what it is. But anyway, I wanted to talk about the conversation you had with Michael Sperconish, and I love any conversation that just talks about both the media, but then the history of it therein.
Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to talk about and how even, you know, with all these channels, whether it's satellite, cable, or internet or anything, it's just a sad fact and how there's very few news programs that just give you just straight news, like, you know, here's what happened, here it is, and there you go, and that's it. I mean, there's no opinion. It's just kind of a fly-on-the-wall view of what went on in the world that day. And after, you know, my friends have cable and some of them have satellite, and when I browse through a whole bunch of different channels and options, the only ones that I can really find that kind of cater to that taste of mine
mm-hmm.
would probably be Vice TV or Frontline or BBC News or even, like, the News Hour on TBS. I mean, they're not perfect,
right.
But they're pretty close. But it's just like I can see – I mean, I think CNN, Fox, or even MSNBC, they've gotten so bad that even the president himself has poked fun at them, whether it's at that correspondence dinner or just in regular conversations. But
yeah.
But the cool thing about the internet is that it's almost like a time capsule, and I like to kind of browse through old clips of Ed Murrow and even like Walter Cronkite, and granted, you have to kind of desperately see through the cigarette smoke that they've got, but still, they kind of had this format where, you know, here's what happened, here it is, and there you go. And, you know, I kind of missed that.
I agree, and the other part of that is that you can't see a lot of that old Vietnam coverage, for example, from Huntley and Brinkley or from Walter Cronkite, because Disney has so aggressively lobbied to extend copyright laws to save the mouse that stuff is still under copyright. And so if you put it up on YouTube, they will take it down, as a copyright violation. And these libraries are not being made openly available. I think copyrights should, I'm not opposed to copyrights. I mean, to a certain extent, I make my living with copyrights in as much as we sell podcasts and I sell books. But I have no problem with, you know, in fact, you know, we used to give away our show through WhiteRoseSociety.org. And, you know, if it was 2 weeks late or something like that, you could get the show for free over there. And I'm not sure why they stopped carrying it. I think maybe they're having some problems. I tried to communicate with them. But and with my books, we've taken two of my books, Unequal Protection, my book about Citizens United, and Rebooting the American Dream, my 11-point prescription to return America to greatness, and we put them up for free over at truthout.org. I mean, every single word in every single chapter. And I think that, you know, after 5 years, 10 years, something like that, something reasonable, not 80 years or not life of the author plus 60 years or whatever it is now, I think after a relatively short period of time, copyrights should expire, and that would give us access to those old channels, and that would make that time capsule of the Internet even better. David, excellent point. Thanks for listening to AM 1350. Brian in Tinley Park, Illinois. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi. I'm an honor to talk to you. I just wanted to maybe talk about some of the things that David just talked about, but also about the state of radio and media in general. I used to be in radio. I was in radio for about 15 years. I got out of it late 90s. But I can remember when I first got in, the rule was one AM and one FM station per market, per company.
Right.
With no cross-ownership whatsoever.
And you couldn't own a newspaper.
Right, except for the companies that were grandfathered in already.
Yeah.
But I remember, like you said, during Reagan's administration with Capital Cities ABC, that's when things really changed. Because because just prior to that, GE had bought out NBC, and the rule was that they had to divest themselves of all the radio properties.
Yep.
And they went ahead and complied, but Cap Cities ABC decided not to.
Yep.
And they fought it, and they were allowed to keep their properties. And that's when things totally went out of whack.
Yep.
I mean, if you take a look at some of the big markets, you can see that there are, you know, like you said, Cumulus and Clear Channel. But if you look even further down in the medium and the small markets, say, or cities, what you see is where you've got one or two companies really owning pretty much all of the major radio stations in a town. And you know, you wonder where you get this kind of single-mindedness of opinion, especially when you get into small rural areas, and I think that's where you get it.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why all you can get is right-wing talk radio in much of the United States. Right-wing talk radio is there to serve the interests of the corporate class. It's there to serve the interests of the top 1%. And it's there to convince the average working guy that the interests of the corporate class and the top 1% are his interests or her interests. And that's why it's ubiquitous. And I really believe that, I mean, there are a few stations. There's in Vermont, WDEV. Ken Squire owns that station. He's an old friend of mine. And they carry our show. They carry Brunch with Bernie. And because it's Vermont. And they carry left and they carry right and they carry a lot of local voices. And it's a very eclectic mix. But it's owned by, you know, Ken and his wife Elizabeth. And it was started by his father in the 1920s or 1930s. And those kind of stations are few and far between, and they're national treasures. We really need to be thinking about our media landscape. Brian, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I should add, Brian was just calling, listening to WCPT in Chicago, which is owned by a guy who lives in Chicago. It's a locally owned, you know, business. God bless him. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Alpheus in Andrews, South Carolina, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, what's up? Alpheus? He must be listening to his television instead of his phone. Here's the deal. It takes about 30 seconds or so for the signal to go from me to the internet to Denver to the satellite converter to up to the satellite and then back down from the satellite to your house and through all the electronics and into your home. I know everything's supposed to travel at the speed of light, but it doesn't. And so when you're on hold, you need to listen to your telephone, which is actual real-time communication. It actually is speed of light rather than watch your TV, because there is also an intentional delay built in. We also have a 9-second delay here. So if somebody says something obscene on the air, we can push a button and make it go away. It doesn't change the video, but it can change the audio. So please listen to your phone rather than watching your TV once you're on hold. Earl in Colorado City, Colorado, watching Free Speech TV. What's up, Earl?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Earl.
Thank you. I called you about a month ago, and you took my call. I thank you for it. I called in Sunday. I still on the long-term unemployment, and they said, don't call no more.
Who'd you call?
Denver, where you got to call in every 2 weeks. And
are you called the unemployment office?
No, the Cub Line. They call it.
Cub Line. What's that?
Where you call in every 2 weeks to file.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's the unemployment office.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
And pretty much they said, don't call no more. So
right.
Don't want to clog up the.
Right. Until John Boehner decides to allow the House of Representatives to have a vote on this thing, you guys are screwed.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to say
it. My question is, Is it a law they have to vote on it, or they don't even have to vote for it?
It is. Law is not quite the right word. It's an appropriation, but it's the exact same process as a law. It has been passed by the Senate, and it would give you a fairly large check, which would take you retroactive from Christmas last year up until today, and then for another month or two, it would pay your unemployment, your long-term unemployment benefits. It passed the Senate. There were actually Republicans who voted for it in the Senate. It is sitting in the House of Representatives. If John Boehner would allow it there to be a vote, he controls what comes to the floor for a vote and what doesn't. If it came to the floor for a vote, all of the Democrats would vote for it, which would make it 19 votes short of passing. And there is no doubt in anybody's mind that at least 19 Republicans would vote for it, probably more like 100 or so. But John Boehner will not bring this to a vote in the House of Representatives. And the reason why is because the Republican strategy is inflict pain on the American people as you go into this election, into November. Inflict as much pain as possible, and economic pain is the worst kind of pain. Inflict as much pain as possible because 80% of Americans don't know who controls Congress. And so because they don't know that it's exclusively Republicans who are doing this to them, they assume because the president is a Democrat and he's in the White House, and everybody thinks the president has more power than he has, they think it must be Obama's fault and therefore the Democrats' fault. And so they will vote Republican in November. This is the Republican strategy. They think if they can make you hurt enough, Earl, that you will be angry enough at Democrats that you will vote for a Republican. And, you know, I get it that you figured out that it's the Republicans who are doing this. It's one guy standing in the way, John Boehner, and you can call his office every 2 weeks. Thanks a lot for calling. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org, or .com, whichever it is. I lost my cheat sheet here. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, let's start with some office politics.
Okay.
Jill Abramson, the executive editor of the New York Times, is unexpectedly leaving the position. She's out.
Why?
Suddenly, this afternoon.
Why?
Bit of a mystery.
Huh.
Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the paper, said it was an issue with management in the newsroom. Now, why am I leading with this? Because this impacts the political news and how the news is reported or can.
Right. So the question, I mean, the New York Times has skewed toward facts, which in the right-wing talk radio world means liberal. They've reported on things like global warming and Thomas Piketty and the economy and the Republican obstruction and things like that. They just report the facts. And so are they going to replace her with somebody who is not, who, you know, increasing?
No, they're replacing her with Dean Baquet, who's the managing editor of the paper.
Right.
He's a 57. He's the first African-American executive editor of the New York Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and a former editor of the Los Angeles Times.
So let's hope that he will be as dedicated to the facts as she was.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it's fascinating. Sulzberger said that he would not address directly the reason that was on everybody's mind.
Yeah, your phone is breaking up pretty badly, Victoria. I mean, this might have just simply been a personality dispute, you think?
It could be. He said it was not about the journalism, the direction of the newsroom, or the relationship between the newsroom and business sides of the paper.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sometimes management just decides to change things.
Sometimes they do.
Yeah. What else is up?
Lawmakers on the Hill are ratcheting up some pressure on the White House to do more in response to the kidnapping of hundreds of Nigerian girls. House leaders have asked the White House for a briefing, which they believe they'll get next week when the chamber's back in session. The women of the Senate have banded together with all 20 of them, signing a letter imploring President Obama to ask the UN to classify Boko Haram as a terrorist group and impose other sanctions against the group. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, Senator John McCain and in special forces, he says that as the UN Charter recognizes crimes against humanity and that this is a crime against humanity, that gives any nation the license that they can stop a crime against humanity, so that the U.S. could do that.
Interesting. Yeah, I've, you know, John McCain's answer to everything, of course, is send in forces or nuke them. But But
he was keen on that, it seems.
Yeah, and that's a part of the world where sending in forces could be at least as problematic as it is in Syria, for example.
It's tricky. The reason I'm so close to my screen is because my phone seems to be getting a better signal.
Oh, okay, good.
That's why he's got such a big face.
Yeah, okay.
Senator Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, today called on the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, to reject proposed regulations governing consumers' Internet use. Now, the FCC will vote tomorrow to advance new net neutrality rules.
Yeah. Hey, we just took your Skype audio, and it sounds pretty good. It sounds better than your phone does. So
should I keep my phone or drop it?
Yeah, it's up to you, but we're listening to your Skype audio right now.
So it would allow Internet providers to charge companies for faster data delivery speeds. Now, Markey says, imagine just a few companies deciding that C-SPAN.org will be put into a slow lane, that public interest content streamed out to the world will be sent out at an even more deliberative pace, while Kittim videos will get priority.
Right, or Fox will be fast and C-SPAN will be slower and, you know, or whatever. I mean, it's
exactly.
Is Markey calling for the simple solution, which is classify ISPs as common carriers like phone companies? Let's just, you know, go back to where we were before the Bush administration, before Michael Pollan.
It doesn't say in this article, but most Democrats are arguing for that.
Right.
Most Democrats are arguing for that.
Good.
Top House Republicans are telling the FCC today, and that includes Speaker John Boehner, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, and Kathy McMorris, that they should not issue these rules also.
Oh, really? So the lobbyists are passing out big money with the Republicans, because the Republicans, I mean, the Tea Party base used to be pretty emphatic about, we want an open Internet so we can talk to each other.
Yeah, no, they're saying that they should be focused on unleashing the full job-creating potential of the private sector, including the Internet, rather than stifling such growth through expansions of federal power. Now, on the other hand...
Wait a minute, that's double talk.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, pardon me. On the other hand...
Unlike Democrats, they do not want the FCC to reclassify broadband Internet as a telecommunications service, however.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, so they want the opposite. So it's going to be very interesting to see which way the vote will go. It's not at all clear. The two Republican commissioners are expected to be definite no votes. It's the Democratic commissioners that it's not clear about. One Democratic commissioner definitely asked for the vote to be delayed. The other Democratic commissioner has expressed grave doubts about all the opposition coming in and all the objections, and has seemed very concerned. But will they feel obliged to vote with Wheeler? That's what we don't know.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, what else is up?
Bill Clinton today, former president, said he was dumbfounded by Karl Rove's remarks about Hillary Clinton and his suggestions of brain damage. He said, first they said she faked her concussion, and now they say she's auditioning for a part on The Walking Dead. I mean, you know, whatever it takes.
Well, this is the fourth time now Karl Rove has done this. They, you know, he labeled that one guy as a pedophile once, got that, you know, that guy, his name was Kennedy, as I recall. He wasn't one of the Kennedys. And there were two other cases. I mean, this is an old trick for Karl Rove, you know? Spread rumors by spreading rumors. By the way, there's no truth to the rumor that Karl Rove has been a heroin addict for the last 6 years. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure to tell everybody, Karl Rove is not a heroin addict. He really isn't.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, fairer and only slightly unbalanced. We had an interesting conversation in our first hour with Michael Smirkanish about the nature of our media and what's really going on there. That has kind of morphed into conversations about media consolidation and consolidation across all sectors of business in America, and what that, you know, this all being the result of Reagan deregulating the mergers and acquisitions in 1982, and you know, what that has meant, you know, for a lot of us, what it's meant. I'm just speaking as a guy in the media who, and an independent, I own this show, is that we're going to lots and lots of different platforms. You can hear us on Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. You can hear us on our own website at TomHartmann.com, on YouTube, at on our YouTube channel, on, you know, of course, on radio stations all across the country. We're on Pacifica radio stations across the country, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, lots and lots of small ones, KBCS up in Seattle, X-Ray FM in Portland, carrying us now. There's American Forces Radio, of course, Free Speech TV carrying the signal all over the country, into 60 million homes on DirecTV and Dish and on a couple hundred cable systems. So it's, reorganization, I guess, of the media landscape happening right now. And for those listening, you know, on AM Talk Radio, well, who knows, you know, what the future may bring. But just know that there's lots and lots of ways to get the show. And so, you know, we'll continue the conversation about that. And in our second hour, we were talking about how the Republican chaos strategy is now being applied to the Veterans Administration. I want to get back to that. But there was an interesting piece in Time magazine last week. This guy named Tal Fortgang said, "I'll never apologize for my white privilege." And I read his piece this morning, and I was like, this is the most shallow. I mean, this guy, I don't think, understands white privilege. He's talking about how his parents were Holocaust survivors and they pulled themselves up from the bootstraps when they came to America. And isn't that a wonderful thing? And so I wanted to get Daniel Jose Older back on the program. We talked somewhat about this topic the last time when we were talking about this white savior narrative that we find in so many movies, Django and whatnot. Daniel, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It is always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I should add, you are a writer, editor, composer, contributor over at Salon.com, and your website is GhostStar, GhostStar.net. Do I have all that right?
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool. So,
where to even begin?
Right? Yeah, well, I got to tell you, you know, as an old white guy, it's really only been in the later part of my life that I came to understand that one of the biggest privileges associated with white privilege is never wondering if things have happened to me because of my race. You know, right. Is not wondering, did that waiter give me a bad table because of my race? Did that taxi driver not pick me up because of my race? Did I not get that job or that apartment because of my race? I've never in my life wondered that. And that's the experience of most middle-class white people. And therefore, they don't. It doesn't even occur to them that that's white privilege. Let me toss that to you.
Which is in itself a privilege.
Yeah, it's in and of itself huge. I mean, it's huge. It's like the quality, your quality of life. I mean, so.
Right. Because people of color have been having the privilege conversation since the dawn of race and all of our lives. So
yeah,
there is that disconnect right off the bat.
Right. So I'm assuming you had an opportunity to read this guy's piece too.
I did, unfortunately.
So, yes. You know, first of all, he would not come on the program. We invited him on, and he's like, And
probably for the best.
But I just want to put it out there that we gave him an opportunity to come on and,
sure,
and speak for himself.
Sure.
So I don't feel bad about talking about him. Typically, I don't talk about people who aren't here to defend themselves. But if they explicitly turned down an opportunity to do so,
on them.
Yeah, I'm not going to trash him, but I'm just saying.
Sure.
But basically, you know, what I read into this was my family, much of my family died in the Holocaust. My parents or my grandparents survived and came over here. And they were poor, and they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, and so did my parents, and so did I. And I'm in a Ivy League college, and why should I apologize for that? And why should I check my privilege? Am I accurately characterizing his piece, in your opinion?
I think that was an excellent, excellent rendition of what he said.
Okay, so
that covers it.
So can you deconstruct that? I mean, what's wrong with that?
Well, there's a number of things that are happening here. First off, I think we got to begin with the fact that, and you alluded to this already, but the prose is appalling. It's really a poorly written article. There's a lot of overwriting, and there's no analysis really happening. There's a lot of shallowness. But it's here on Time Magazine, and that alone speaks to a whole lot of privilege happening, because I know plenty of writers of color who write 8 million times better than this on Twitter every day and many other places, and they're not showing up on Time Magazine.
Yeah.
Time actually plucked this out of a college paper.
Yeah.
So let's begin there. Beyond that, I think the idea that anybody has asked him to apologize, he sort of makes this jump from being called out on his privilege to this concept of apology. The conversation about privilege isn't about people apologizing. It's about people taking ownership and responsibility of what's gotten them there.
Right.
It's about having an institutional analysis, and what he's done is made it very, very personal and very individual. And that is the constant kind of, you know, siren song of privilege. It's like, it's all about me, and let me tell you why it's all about me, and therefore, ergo this, that, and the other. And no one was really talking about him. We were talking about the institutions that got him there and why that matters.
Right. Right. And I mean, what was he missing? What, you know, if you could speak to him, what would you say?
And where to begin, like I said. I mean, I think it's about stepping back from, like I said, stepping back from his own personal narrative and understanding himself be a piece of a much larger puzzle than just this one person.
I wanted to say to him, it's I don't think he understands what white privilege is. And
yeah, that's very clear.
Would it be, I mean, I don't know if this is a totally off the wall thing, but if there was a black institution where there was a black power structure and it was a largely black community or an entire, you know, largely black community, and a white person was there and they were being dissed on a regular basis, or they were not getting ahead and they were not succeeding. And there may be such places, maybe in an all black college or something. I don't know. But
right.
I frankly doubt it, but because I think that there's awareness, right, of privilege. But could there be black privilege that he could be the victim of?
Well, here's where context really matters. So there's moments where white people will feel excluded, and they will have their feelings hurt about things, and maybe based on their race at times. But that's a whole other conversation from when we're talking about an institutional form of oppression.
Right.
So when we're talking about, we're not just talking about the individual moment of the college either, just like we're not talking about the individual person. It's not about this one school and what's going on there. It's about the larger context of the United States of America,
yeah,
and institutional racism
and what you,
from the beginning.
What you're saying is what I've said for years, and I constantly get into arguments with mostly white people about this, and
sure,
that is that I say black people can't be racist, because to be a racist, you have to
right.
be able to enforce your bigotry. They can be bigoted. And
they don't have the institutional backing.
Exactly. Right. Whereas white people can actually wield the power and do.
Correct. And whether they want to or not. And I think that's where people get caught up, because again, they say, oh, but I didn't choose this. I don't want this. It doesn't matter. You have it. It works for you. If you know, it goes into play whenever you feel in danger, whenever you enter a neighborhood for, you know, this reason or that, those institutions are already set up. So it doesn't matter what you want. You can be against it, and you can be an anti-racist white person, but you don't get to say, well, you know, I don't have to deal with this because it's just not something that I asked for.
Yeah, no.
Man, no one asked for this situation.
Yeah, I'm very clear about that, we're running out of time. Daniel Jose Older, brilliant. It's always great talking with you, sir.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Thank you.
To the next time.
Ghoststar.net is the website, and of course he contributes to Salon.com, writer, editor, composer, and we will be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What do you think white privilege is? What do you think racism is? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, how you doing?
Hey, you know what white privilege means to me?
What?
It means that you could be a police officer or a politician and apologize the day after you say something totally obscene and racist and not suffer any other consequence. No decrease in pay, no demotion, nothing. Just say you're sorry, and it doesn't have to actually mean anything.
Well, not just say something offensive. It means that you can actually, like, beat up a person of color or arrest them or harm them in a way that there's little or no justification for, or trample their property. And then if you're called on it, maybe apologize and suffer very little consequence. I mean, that's a fairly common experience, I think, in minority communities in America.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
And that's right at the core of stop and frisk.
The previous hour explaining the hows and the whys behind Air America's failure and the state of right-wing media dominance in this country. You did a really good job. And I've never been to your website, but I hope there's a feature on there where people can go, where they can click on highlighted speeches. Have you a feature like that?
Highlighted speeches of whom?
Stuff when you have pearls of wisdom like that that you can explain within
two,
3 minutes where people can go who are looking for, like, your take on things, important stuff of the day.
Well, thank you. We have that, Johnny.
Further educate themselves.
Yeah, we have that. First of all, we have podcasts where people can get the entire program. But for little bits and pieces like what you're talking about, we have a YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/Tom Hartman, and there's a link to it off our homepage at tomhartman.com. It's totally free. And every single day, Jim puts up little clips, probably a total of maybe 30 minutes worth of various bits and pieces of the show, and tosses them up on YouTube there where people can watch them. And people do watch them. And so, yeah. You wanted to talk about mandatory voting?
Yeah, mandatory voting and tax exemptions.
Mm-hmm.
I think mandatory voting is really ridiculous to have. You wouldn't have to have that if you allowed people like me, when you show up at the voting booth, if I don't like my choices, I can enter none of the above, and maybe a 20-character explanation of why. And if I pay an extra $5, I get to have a 400-character explanation of why.
That's
and tax exemptions? You know, these Republicans in Arizona and New Mexico, Nevada and Texas, they love giving tax breaks to the folks like Walmart and Hollywood film production companies. Why not a tax break to Tesla? Let's see what their reaction is to that.
Well, they actually did give a tax break to Tesla, and they also gave them a low-interest loan, which Tesla has paid back. And it's one of the things that made Tesla possible. Tesla was one of the companies that benefited under President Obama's stimulus program. But I like your idea, and I'm fine with that, by the way. And I like your idea of the penny just dropped for me. What if we were to say, you know, right now, like, you get a tax exemption if you have kids, right? Or get a tax exemption if you have a home mortgage with a bank. So we want to encourage that kind of behavior. What if we give a tax exemption to people who vote? What if by voting you can take $50 off your taxes every year? Or $100.
How about a tax exemption if you finish high school?
Yeah, I'm not sure how you'd do that and how long it would last. But I think with voting, you could do it every couple of years. You would have to demonstrate that you voted, I'm not sure that our system is, you know, coherent enough. There's enough interaction between local voting and the IRS. And that would get the IRS into the voting databases, and that's going to make a lot of Republicans very hysterical. Interesting. Johnny, always good talking with you. Thanks for calling. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. This is one. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Howard in Hollywood, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Hey, Tom, based on your science section, when I breathe heavily around an attractive woman now, I can tell her not to worry. I'm just cooling my brain off.
That's correct. Yeah. The science news of the week, they've discovered that yawning isn't the result of actually being fatigued. One of the side effects of fatigue is that your circulatory system becomes less efficient at cooling your brain. And so to grab a quick gulp of cold air against the roof of your mouth, where it will cool the vascular system, all the veins and arteries that are going to the brain.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff, isn't it?
Buy that. I don't think you're going to transfer that easily.
Yeah.
But the other thing.
Your next date will not buy that.
I've got another point, but another quickie point.
Uh-huh.
The idea of being pulled up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
Those underprivileged don't have bootstraps.
Excellent point. This was how Lyndon Johnson sold the war on poverty, was, and this was a big phrase back in the 60s, if you're old enough to remember it, was, we're giving people a hand up, not a hand out,
right. We're
helping people pull themselves up by their bootstraps by giving them bootstraps. And those were, good ways to think about it, because basically that's what the war on poverty was. It didn't just say, oh, you're poor, here's a bunch of money, stay poor. Instead, it was, very specific supports that got people out of poverty so that they could get into the productive workplace, that they could stay in school, so they could, all the things that you want people to do.
Now, my big point.
Yeah.
We let things go too easily. Look what the Republicans have done with Benghazi. They're making it into a joke.
Yeah.
We had the government shut down. Now we've got clear evidence that Edwin Meese was responsible. Why? Now, it won't be done in the House, but why doesn't the Senate hold Meese-Ghazi?
Meese-Ghazi. Because the Democrats who run the Senate do not have the stomach for investigative circuses for things that aren't real. They will do it for real things. The last time was probably the Church Committee back in the 70s. But they just don't play those kind of games, and I think it's because
the shutdown was real, Tom. $24 billion worth of reality.
Yeah,
these are the misers that won't spend $6 billion for additional.
So, but what's the I get that, and the tragedy, and the Republicans know this, is that more than 80% of Americans don't realize that the Republicans basically control the House and Senate. Between a filibuster and the majority,
that will make this very clear. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We will have an issue right up to the next election that will literally drive the Republicans up the wall.
Yeah.
They won't know how to deal with it being investigated. And all the Republicans.
So what's the crime? What's being investigated?
The fact that Edwin Meese planned the government shutdown.
He just sat in a meeting room with a bunch of Republicans the same way Newt Gingrich did back in 2009, January 20th, 2009, at the Caucus Room restaurant when they decided to oppose everything Obama did. I mean, this was just...
Well, I think that should be investigated, too, except you said there's no basis for it. At least in the case of the government shutdown, that's sedition.
Well, it was a government shutdown.
Look at the people that they hurt. Look at the damage that they did. $24 billion wasted?
Yeah,
that's
and
a
the
joke.
Downgrade of the country's credit rating and everything else.
Right.
Ed Meese.
That is investigatable. What? Get Bernie to do it.
Yeah. Good luck on that.
Serious.
You have to get Harry Reid to do it. This is the kind of stuff that has to come out of the leader's office and exclusively. I mean, or maybe a committee chair, but it would have to be a committee. I'm not sure which committee would even look into that, frankly, in the Senate. But it certainly wouldn't be one of the committees that, the only committee that Bernie's a chair of is veterans. And so that wouldn't be possible unless he could demonstrate that veterans were somehow hurt by it, possibly. But the whole thing that Ed Meese was there, I've been scratching my head ever since that, because if you remember back in the 80s when Ed Meese was the attorney general, Reagan wanted to do something about pornography. Because there had been that decision in the 70s, the Linda Lovelace case in the Supreme Court, and they decided that, pornography was legal. We were going to dial back on censorship and pretty much limit it to child porn and snuff porn, And Ed Meese chaired a pornography commission that viewed hundreds of hours of the worst kind of pornography, including the kinds that are totally illegal to this day, that viewed hundreds of hours of this pornography and concluded that, yes, indeed, this stuff warps people's minds and causes brain damage. And I'm just wondering does that explain Ed Meese?
I wonder if he breathed heavily.
good question. Howard, thanks a lot for the call. Mr. Cam, listening on WVAI in New Rochelle, New York. Hey, what's up?
Yes, now at the phone?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. You were talking about some place around the Canary Island area
where they had no fossil fuels at all. Is that right?
Yeah, that was in our newscast last week, and it was an island nation that has succeeded in that. By the way, Germany last week had a day where 74% of all the electricity consumed in the country was generated by solar or wind.
Right. I think most of the Europeans are pretty close to that figure. But there's another place in northern Denmark where they have also achieved zero fossil fuels. And they sell electricity to a surrounding area.
Yeah.
So that's I understand they have 10,000 people up there. So it's not small. And they must have a lot of some wind power, solar power.
They may have
solar.
Yeah, they may have some dams on some big rivers too, because since
some
of those areas you get these glaciers melting. But I, you know, I
have dams around.
We did our show 2 years ago.
We're kind of like 90% dependent on fossil fuels, and it's not going up appreciably despite all of the hoopla.
Yeah. Well, actually, it is. The United States doubled its solar capacity last year. Now, granted, that's like from, you know, less than 1% to slightly less than 2%, but we doubled our solar capacity, and we need to be increasing it, you know, more and more. We did our show from Reykjavik, 3 years ago for a whole week, and Iceland, 98 or 99% of all the heat in that city and most of the electricity is generated by volcanoes, by, you know, the heat out of the ground. So, Mr. Cam, lots and lots of options. Thanks for listening to WBAI.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I totally agree that America needs to get with the program. Now. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you, 28 minutes before the hour, and Libby in Washington State working on the Washington Move to Amend petition, wamend.org. Libby, you should call I asked you to call every day because I want to plug what you guys are doing, but we have different listeners in each hour because, you know, people get off work, they're driving, they're listening, whatever, so you should call in different hours every day, okay?
Oh, okay, yeah. Yesterday I did call towards the end of the program,
yeah.
But I will just rotate that every day.
So very quickly, give us the plug.
Okay, I wanted to direct people to the website, not only to donate, but to see our incredible creativity in that we have Businesses for Democracy, where we've fixed up a petition box. People can look up, where do I sign the petition, and find a business close to them. If they can't find a petition gatherer nearby, go into our website and find a petition in a nearby business. And I'd love to have businesses get in touch with us if they would also like to carry the petitions in their in their places, and we'll get one to
Great.
You.
And the website is wamend.
Yeah.
Or wamend.org. Okay, Libby, thank you very much for the call. Keep up the great work. Marty in Encinitas, California. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for letting me follow Wamend again.
Sure.
I'm crying right now, and I'm going to keep it together. I've gone through 4 California wildfires.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a bit different. This one is called Caused by Climate Change. California's burning.
Yeah.
And the East Coast is drowning. And I am still hearing people tell me that climate change is a hoax. I'd like some words. What do you say when, in spite of every obvious fact, people don't want to believe? What do I say?
Well, I would say you listen to scientists. If the scientist happens to be your doctor who tells you that you have cancer or heart disease, you'd listen to that, wouldn't you? You would listen to somebody who understands science. If it was an electrician in your house telling you that your electric panel was going to burst into flames if you didn't replace some of the breakers, we listen to the scientists, all the various pieces of our car that all work together because of various laws of physics, the computer, the telephone, the television. I mean, all of these things are based on science. We don't challenge any of that science. Why are we selectively challenging the science that says that burning fossil fuels is altering the chemistry of our planet. And please let me inform you that there is a reason. It's the same reason that back in the 1980s, there were people challenging the science that said that smoking causes cancer. And it's because the smoking industry, the tobacco industry, was passing out hundreds of millions of dollars over years, over decades, tens of millions of dollars, millions of dollars a year, to so-called scientists and think tanks and spokespeople to go out and say, well, you know, it's still a debate about whether smoking causes cancer or not. And eventually the science became so overwhelming and the consensus was so great, and it even went to court, that basically, I mean, you know, here's the good news. Libya, I think the name was. The good news is, I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., and 20 years ago, in this city, the most powerful lobby, the one lobby you didn't want to mess with, the lobby that could take down any politician, was the tobacco industry. It was the tobacco lobby. Tobacco lobbyists had so much power in this city 20, 25 years ago. It was mind-boggling. Nobody challenged them. And then Mike Papantonio and a bunch of other good lawyers got up and said, okay, we're going to take these guys on, and took them down. And now the tobacco lobby in Washington, D.C. is one of the weakest lobbies there is. The same thing, that same arc, you know, Martin Luther King, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it curves towards justice. That arc, it's taking longer than it should, I agree, but it is curving toward awakening. And as more and more extreme weather events happen, you know, please, despair is not an option. Despair is not a useful emotion. Take that emotion that you're feeling and convert it into activism. Find a group that's working on climate change that you can throw some time or energy into, that you can make some phone calls on behalf of, that you can send out some emails for, that you can leaflet for, that you can do some lobbying for, that you can, you know, whatever. Become an activist, and you will discover that despair, which can be paralyzing, is turned into action that can actually help save the world. And this is what we all need to do. I hope I don't sound like I'm too A, lecturing, or B, Pollyanna-ish, but this is the reality is that every time we have confronted major crises, whether it was scientific crises like, you know, tobacco killing people, or and you know, there being a debate about it, or whether it's, you know, the crisis of Jim Crow laws, or, you know, women being totally disenfranchised, or I, you know, pick your poison, right? In every single case, there were some people who were in despair, who cried about it, who were so, you know, and I'm not saying that that's not an appropriate response in as a first response. This is kind of the five stages of death and grieving, you know, that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross taught us about. You know, the first, you know, this shock, this is despair. Go from there into anger and then response. What is it that Mahatma Gandhi used to say? First they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. The fossil fuel industry used to ignore us. They stopped doing that. Then they started ridiculing us, saying, ah, there's a debate about the science. There's no such thing about the science. That is not working anymore. The Los Angeles Times won't even publish things from climate deniers any longer. They're starting to be viewed like Holocaust deniers. So the then they ridicule you is not working so much. So then they fight you. Now they've actually got people out there saying, oh, carbon dioxide is good. And we'd be in an ice age if it wasn't for right now. And plants need it. And it's wonderful. They're going to lose. Because they're on the wrong side of science. They're on the wrong side of history. So this is actually all good news. And it should inspire you. And it should get you active. Please. Paul in Chicago. Hey, Paul, what's up? Thanks for listening to CPT.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Hartman. I appreciate all your hard work and diligence on everything. I just want to let you know that when it comes to issues, that whatever you and Bernie say, that's my take on it. But in regards to net neutrality, I think there's two things going on here. First of all, I'm for net neutrality. But then, if somebody's getting it speed better, if a store, like say Walmart, is shipping internet at a higher speed, then shouldn't I, as a consumer, prorate my bill accordingly? Because if I'm asking, like, see, for my mom, if she only needs 20 megabits per second, because all she does is just email pictures or documents, whereas I need 100 because I have in my home I have 5 smartphones, a couple iPads.
Or you want to watch streaming video or something. Yeah.
Video,
no, I get your point.
I need 100.
Here's the thing, Paul. What you're describing has nothing to do with net neutrality. When you classify a company as a product as a common carrier, whether it's trucking companies are considered common carriers, taxis, common carriers, Amtrak, common carriers, airlines, common carriers, the phone company, common carrier. What that means is it doesn't mean that you can't charge less for slower speed or more for faster speed. It doesn't mean that you can't, that if they're moving a trucking company's moving your furniture across the country, it doesn't mean that they can say, they can't say, hey, if you want us to get this across the country in 3 days, that'll cost less than in 5 days. It doesn't mean that. What it means is that they can't inspect the contents, essentially, and discriminate against you based on the content. The phone company can't listen into your phone calls and change your phone bill based on the nature of your phone calls. But they can say, if you use more than 300 minutes, you're going to pay X. If you use more than 1,000 minutes, you're going to pay Y. The Internet service providers can say, if you want 5 MIPS download, 5 megabytes per second download, it's this speed. If you want 100 MIPS download, it's that speed. It's a higher speed. They can say that because that has to do with the volume of the total content. What they can't say, if they get classified as common carriers, if we have true net neutrality, what they can't say is if you're downloading content from Netflix, it's going to cost you more than if you're downloading content from Hulu. Am I making sense here, Paul?
No, not quite. I guess what I'm saying is that if, for example, if we have speed limits, right?
Right.
And, so this is what I'm saying. This is the argument that you need to take is if you have a speed limit, right, of, say, 50 miles per hour, and if I get pulled, if I go 60 or 65 miles an hour, and the police pull me over.
That's a whole different thing, Paul. That's the commons. That's our roads. Call back another time. We'll continue the conversation. I'm sorry, we're hitting a break here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more of the news of the day, my take on it, your take on my take, right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Marilyn in the Bronx, New York. Or in Bronx, New York. It's no longer the Bronx. It's Bronx, right?
Yes. I wanted to remind people that Saturday, May 17th, is the 60th anniversary of the Monday, May 17th, 1954 Supreme Court desegregation decision, Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas.
Right. Okay. Thank you for the reminder. It's an important one, and I'm guessing that probably a lot of programming will be devoted to that. We'll certainly have to look at that more carefully for our Friday show. Thank you, Marilyn, for that, and thanks for listening to WBAI. Your phone is kind of flaky there. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening. Betty, let me put you on hold because your station's in a commercial break right now. I'll be right back to you. John, watching Free Speech TV in Thorsby, Alabama. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, buddy. Juan, thank you for being there. I really enjoy listening to you. I wanted to make a quick comment on the state of politics in the wonderful state of Alabama.
Okay.
The first ad that I got to see this political cycle was from a gentleman named Chip Meeks, who's running for
the Public Service Commission.
Uh-huh.
And the entire ad and the ads that have followed have been nothing but anti-Obama and anti-affordable care ads. Not a single thing about any qualification this man may have for being on the Public Service Commission, which, of course, has to do with utility rates.
Right.
And, you know, it just kind of, you know, follows along the line that we've been seeing in this state since approximately 1986 when Guy Hunt was accidentally elected governor. No one was more surprised than him because of a split in the Democratic Party. And that's when this state became a red state instead of the blue state that it had always been. And also, they have managed to eliminate the Affordable Care Act here in this state. Only because of our state legislature and our governor, there is only one insurance company available, and that's Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I don't know anybody that can actually afford that, especially if you don't make a lot of money.
Yes.
I have a daughter that's sick and can't get any health care anywhere because her husband has a minimum wage job, so she doesn't qualify for Medicaid or anything even remotely like that.
Because your governor did not and your legislature did not expand Medicaid in Alabama.
The telecom and the FCC and everything, and I spent more than 25 years in that industry. And, you know, the concept of we always are going to need more bandwidth.
Right.
Always, always, always.
Right.
It's just ridiculous for anybody to even think that, you know, content should determine pricing. I mean,
yeah.
The internet that you have in your own office.
But see, this is the cable TV model, John. If you want MSNBC, you pay an extra $5 a month, at least here in Washington, D.C. If you want Fox, it's free, or it's part of the basic cable package. I mean, they have allowed content to determine pricing, and they want to do that to the Internet, and we can't let them. Thank you, John, for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Is that where we on camera one? Yeah. Drinking my coffee. Oh, what a beautiful day. What a beautiful day. And by the way, I just wanted to mention one last time, in particular because I know that one of our radio stations is going away at the end of this week. And it's interesting. We've added, I think, a total of at least 9 or 10 new stations in the last 4 weeks, 5 weeks. But we have one that's going away on Friday. And so I just want to tell the people who are listening, there's lots of, and you know who you are, there's lots of places to listen to the show, the Progressive Voices on the iTunes app, or TuneIn app, excuse me. We're on iTunes, I believe, yep, and we're on YouTube, we're on, here on our website we've got a stream, Sirius XM, on, we're live on their app, and we're time delayed on the satellite, but we're on both. You can watch us on DirecTV, on Dish TV. We have podcasts available. There's a lot of choices and a lot of ways to listen to the Tom Hartman and interact with the Tom Hartman program. So just a heads up. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on AM 1350. Hey, Betty, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Back to the VA topic.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the public outcry from the right when the most recent Bush administration chose to close 4 to 6 VA hospitals across the country?
I think there was no.
I remember those days. I know that from reading that it relegated a number of citizens in the Midwest to traveling about 400 to 600 miles to get health care, which they probably weren't able to receive because they couldn't make the trip.
Right. They were.
The second subject I wanted to bring up is back to this, the number of people that you say are unaware of who controls Congress.
Right.
At some point at this stage, personal responsibility has to come into play. There is no excuse for any citizen of this country, say by the time of 16, 17 years old, junior, senior in high school, on up, not knowing how their government works.
But, Betty, here's the question. There has been no shortage of news coverage over the last, since Christmas, of the fact that Congress has not extended unemployment benefits. Have you ever once heard in a news report it stated as a fact that John Boehner is refusing to allow a vote in the House of Representatives?
Oh no, I haven't. But it's true. Therein lies the problem. It's an established fact that we get little to no news from corporatized
media. My point exactly. And I'm doing the best I can here, Betty, but I need some help. So pass the word along. Thank you very much for the call. You're absolutely right. Maurice in Bronx, New York. Hey, Maurice, thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio, Progressive Voices. What's up?
I wanted to point out, you were talking before about billionaires buying retreats. And you mentioned the Bush family, and I wanted to point out that what the Bush family did between 2005 and 2006 was to buy 300,000 acres in Paraguay.
Paraguay. I was trying to remember the country, and yeah. At least that's what has been reported in fairly credible media, yes.
It's been reported. It's all over the Internet. But yeah. The reason, it seems, that they bought that property was not for a retreat, but because it sits on the world's largest freshwater aquifer.
Yeah.
And what these people are buying is, water's the new oil.
Yep.
And they're buying it all up.
Yeah, it was an investment. Yes. You're right.
They want to control the water supply.
Yeah. And if you go back and you look at the history of the control of water supply in South America and, how Bechtel got in trouble, and that wasn't— was that Paraguay where they tried to, where they privatized the entire water supply system, and Bechtel came, it was one of the investors, and they came in and they said, you've got to buy a permit from us to catch rainwater off your roof, and the people basically revolted and threw them out? Or was that Ecuador, or I forget which country that was?
I can't answer that, but I can tell you that it's illegal to privatize water supply in Mexico.
That's interesting.
You can't drill a well, and you can't, and there are parts of this country that are trying to prohibit people from collecting rainwater.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to mention something about net neutrality as well.
Certainly.
Because I think it's what we're talking about, and I'm on the extreme on this. I think the Internet should be nationalized.
I agree.
There's an extremely interesting piece in the New York Times this morning by Thomas Edsel. An analysis of the criticism of Thomas Piketty's book, mm-hmm. Capital in the 21st Century.
Right.
He links to an article by Dean Baker at the Economic Policy Institute. And what we're really talking about is private industry acquiring rents. The biggest example of rents that I can think of, besides what Baker talks about, and I recommend you read the article, is Walmart. Walmart, in its policies of paying its people, know exactly what those levels are that force their employees onto Medicaid and food stamps.
Right, so that we pick up the cost of subsidizing their employees.
We pick up the tab.
Yeah, that's their business model.
Walmart's heirs, Walmart earned $27 billion in profit last year that went directly to the shareholders. And to go back to Piketty's book, who's talking about inherited wealth, the four heirs of Sam Walton did nothing to build that company, but put together are the largest, the wealthiest people in America, in the world.
Right.
So what we... what we dole out to Walmart's employees in terms of Medicaid and food stamps and other public assistance goes directly to their pockets.
Yeah, and this is their business model, and it has now become McDonald's business model and Burger King's business model and the entire fast food industry's business model, and it's spread across this country, and it's a horrible, horrible business model. Maurice, thanks for the call and for the brilliant analysis. Anyhow, it is at the end of the day. Wrap it up. So let me just reemphasize my point. Despair is not an option. We need to get active. We need to participate. Go to freepress.net or it's Credo Action. CredoAction.com. And because tomorrow is the FCC vote, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.